One of the issues that you see with this is that the people who probably matter the most for the bond markets don't say anything on television. They keep their mouth shut. I mean, if I ever said anything in public domain about what we thought about bonds, I would have certainly got yelled at, if not fired for saying, like, no, you just keep your mouth shut. I mean, even in discussing, you had to just, you know, keep things not reveal any information. Like other people, other firms maybe didn't have this attitude, but I certainly, the group that I was with is that you offered no information about what you thought. You wanted to know what other people thought, but you offered no information.
Welcome to Activist MMT, a podcast about real-world economics, including modern money theory, and how life changes when you discover it. I'm your host, Jeff Epstein. Today's part two in my two-part conversation with author, mathematician, and bond analyst Brian Romanchuk on the basics of the secondary market and how it relates to the primary market. Today in part two, Brian continues describing the participants in the secondary market, why they do what they do, and shares several anecdotes from his many years of experience as a bond analyst for fixed income recipients in Canada. A fuller introduction can be found before part one. But for now, let's get right back to my conversation with Brian Romanchuk. Enjoy.
Is over, and see, now your counterparty, well, they've got $1 billion in bonds, and you know, which is more than they need, so they have to unload the bonds, and so they need to keep this quiet on their side because they've got to trade out of this position. So you dumped a lot of risk on them. So see, basically both sides of that bilateral communication want to keep it quiet. You can't do that on a screen. And that's the thing. See, equities aren't important for the economy. They don't really, you know, it's all games. You know, people trading back and forth. It's like sort of retail. But, you know, fixed income, you are moving large flows of money continuously. And so, you know, you have to be able to move you have to be able to do this without blowing up the market. The U.S. is big enough, they can absorb these big flows. But in a place like Canada, you can't. And so that's why they're like a phone-based system. It might have changed, but the phone-based system was very resistant because of this need to deal bilaterally. And you can't do that through a screen.
Okay. And the internet allows you to do a high quantity of small transactions.
Yeah, but everyone will see it. See, that's the thing. You can say, oh, well,
yeah,
try.
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
But yeah, people will see, well, someone's smacking the thing around, and they'll, like, that's what the high frequency trading is supposed to allow you to do that. It's sort of an algorithm that breaks it up and tries to hide these big orders. That's the theory, but people were looking at it, but in fixed income in Canada, it didn't exist at the time, so I never looked at it. I mean, it was showing up in other markets, but not in Canada. So it was never my job to look at it because there was nothing to do on that front.
Okay. A little while ago, you said reallocation between bonds and equities. I want to make sure I understand what that means. There's number one, reallocation between bonds and equities just means that you or your company just decided that that equities are going to be more lucrative right now, and we want to get rid of our bonds and trade them in for equities because we think that would be more profitable. First of all, I think that's what that means.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just to define, make sure I understand what the definition of bonds and equities. Bonds are, I will get a certain amount of money at a, with a certain interest rate over a certain amount of time. So that the number, you know, the yield will be different, but the face value and the percentage that I get back at the end of that maturity will be a certain amount.
Yeah.
An equity.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. An equity is buying a percent, the right to a percentage of ongoing, I'll say, I know, I don't think income is the exact right term, but an ongoing percentage of a company's income.
Well, you own the company, and like legally, like there's protections because you own a class of shares. So this is like if you're one of the challenges is that companies can have different classes of shares, but generally speaking, for public firms, it's you just say that you own a certain percentage of the firm, and dividends have to be paid out equally. So basically, there's sort of two ways of making money on equity without selling to somebody else. Is in the secondary market is A, the company pays a dividend, and but those aren't guaranteed. It comes out of profits. It's usually they try to keep it as a percentage of profits, and it, you know, hopefully grows over time. But you know, it's a little bit arbitrary, and some profitable companies don't pay dividends. In the tech sector, that was quite that's very popular. The other possibility is someone says, "Hey, we're going to buy this firm out," and they bid to buy it, and it's not really secondary market. They're buying the whole firm, and you have a bid, and then you ship your shares to the thing. You know, that company, the company sort of disappears, but you get paid for it because, you know, for your share. So those are the two ways that you make money in equities, like without selling to some, relying on a greater fool to sell it to. And both of them are based on, hopefully the company is going to be profitable so that, or doesn't necessarily have to be profitable. It has to be useful that someone is willing to pay for control of it. Because in some cases, like tech firms, what will happen is, you know, they've got a new app or something. They're not actually making money, but it could be slotted into a larger firm and they just buy it up. And so you're seeing that in the tech sector. So it's, what is the value? What is the value of the company? And that's what you're betting on. It's uncertain. And that's, So that is sort of the big difference. But also you do have things like real estate and things like that, that, you know, the pension funds that I work for invested in as well.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask just a generic question, broad, and let's just see where it goes. And obviously your experience that you had partially just described is part of this answer. And that is just simply, who purchases and sells bonds? Like, who is the population of people that do these transactions outside of the primary market?
Yeah. The, I printed out, like, there's the, in the U.S., I mean, other countries, it's the flow of funds is the report. It's different. Like, the national accounts, like, it depends on the country, but, like, there's sort of, you have national accounts, you have, like, the GDP. Like, what are the components of GDP? But there's a related set of accounts, which tracks financial flows. And in the U.S., that's called the flow of funds in the Fed. And it goes through and say, what are all the different sort of financial assets that are being bought and sold? And those are tracked. The flow of funds, they were sort of secondary just because of the way sort of conventional mainstream economists never really worried about this stuff too much. So they weren't as well developed. But basically, like if you look at the flow of funds, it's saying, what are all the financial transactions going on in an economy? And they break down by who the owners are, who's issuing the securities and so on and so forth. But there, so there's a table for treasury securities. And I printed it out and I hopefully calculate, but you say, look, who owns the treasuries? And according to my possibly botched spreadsheet, the largest one was actually the rest of the world, which of course doesn't matter because who's the rest of the world? See, it's both the private and the public sector who owns them. And the one that you hear about a lot is foreign central banks, particularly China. It's a big thing, oh, China's buying all the treasuries. But historically, Japan, China has sort of moved their reserves around. I think Japan is actually number one. Like, this used to be the big thing in the old day. Oh, Japan's buying all, but, you know, it became China starting in the 2000s. Because basically, it's reserve management. And so they are large investors, but they own usually short duration bonds, like treasury bills, 1-2 year, where duration, it's how sensitive is the bond price to interest rate movements. And it's sort of like maturity, I guess I could just say maturity. But what you see is, like, let's say the all yields rise by 1%, that will imply, like, across all maturities, which roughly sort of happens. It's not going to be exact, but what you see, it's called a parallel shift. Everything moves by up by 1%. The bonds with long maturities are going to take much larger losses than the short maturity ones. Like, if you have a treasury bill that's going to mature tomorrow, its price is pretty close to 100, and it doesn't matter. Like, it's going to be, you know, oh, rise by, it's nothing. You know, whereas if it's a 30-year bond, 100 basis point, it's a big difference. It's called duration, because that's sort of the bond math is, it's the multiplier for this change of yield, how much money do I gain or lose? And the duration is what you multiply the yield change to get your return. Because, see, if you own... I think, like, let's say a trillion. I think Japan is less than a trillion. I think they're about 700 billion in bonds. They have US dollars. Their job is, it's not for investing in equities. It's not supposed to be taking risk. It's there to, support the currency. Like, in the old days of, you needed reserves and a fixed exchange rate system. And see, China sort of was in that boat because they're pegging their currency. If the yuan, the renminbi, I'm not sure which, if it's falling in value, they have to be able to support it. But they can't do it with, you know, if they have yuan as, you know, they need to be able to buy the currency. And the only way they can buy it in US dollar terms is they need US dollars. And so they would sell bonds and then they'd buy their currency. So if you're pegging your currency, you need these reserves. For Japan, you know, they allow the currency to float, but they do intervene a lot. And generally speaking, you know, they bought a lot because they wanted to keep the yen down. So they tended to buy a lot of bonds. And in theory, it's also because they have a vulnerability for, you know, commodity imports. And so the sort of the horror scenario is, what if our currency is collapsing and there's shortages of raw materials? And that's sort of the worry. If you have a free floating currency, you are dependent on that. You have an external, you need to buy commodities, strategic commodities in a foreign currency. It's not available for sale in your local currency. You just can't, the MMT, while you can buy whatever is available for sale, in the domestic currency, you can't. You have to go into a foreign currency. You know, this is sort of, oh no, the nightmare scenario is that your economy is under pressure because you don't have strategic commodities. And so your currency is falling and it makes it harder. So you have reserves to deal with that. And Japan has greater concerns than other developed countries about commodity imports. Other economic blocks in the developed world tend to a bit more balanced in terms of strategic I mean, the U.S. is now actually almost, I believe they're exporting energy again. So it needs to be liquid. So they have something they can sell quickly. It keeps a fixed value, but they can't leave it in the bank because if you leave it in the bank, you know, deposit insurance is, it's $100,000. Well, you know, if you have $800 billion, $100,000 deposit insurance doesn't do you much good. And that's the thing, is they need something that's guaranteed. So they're big, but it tends to be relatively short duration stuff. But they're one of the big players. Like after that, so if you go in, it's actually the federal government itself. And this is where I think I'd have to digest the number, because some of that is just Social Security counts. And, you know, it's just sort of the funny arithmetic for Social Security, where the government is lending money to itself courtesy of their pension plan, the state pension. But then we're going to put that aside. But some of that is actually... They have their own, you know, they run pension plans, and that's like for their employees. So they're running themselves like a business in a sense. So they have an actual pension plan that allocates. But then the other big one is the Fed. And the Fed, in the modern era, they don't want to be lending to the private sector, but they need to create like the monetary base, like for currency in circulation, what used to be called reserves, settlement balances. They need to own something to offset their liabilities in the monetary base. And so historically, they would buy treasury. They didn't, recent history, if you go back further, they would actually have private debt that they would own as assets. They had to have some assets, and they preferred, okay, we're just going to buy treasuries. And so they would buy treasuries. And in the financial crisis, they went back and they bought, you know, risky stuff. And they also buy mortgages, which are sort of the agencies would have guarantees. So they were sort of in between private and federal securities. But so those are the big ones. Then you have state and local governments, but that some of it is sort of technical. If they want to buy back, like you can't just, bonds are contractually paid, but let's say you want to pay off a bond. Well, you can't. And you're not supposed to go in and bid on the bond. It's bad form to be bidding. But what they do is, they, like, let's say they get a big